You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Guidepost. What you're about to listen to today is a recording from last night's TC presentation by the Striped Bass Management Board. The presentation went pretty late into the night. Thank you to the ladies and staff who stayed to make sure everyone had the opportunity to ask questions. I believe the meeting itself was about 2.5 hours, of which 30 minutes of or so was a presentation and about 2 hours of questions. So greatly appreciated. I think we got a lot of the answers that we were looking for. You got Cody and Tony today. We're going to talk for just a couple minutes and bring up one or two things, one or two points of emphasis, a little bit about what we have live right now. And then the rest of this podcast is going to be the audio from the comment period last night. Now, we did take the liberty to chop out a handful of comments. Not necessarily ones that did or didn't agree with us, but more so ones that were, I think, not contributing to a higher understanding of the management going on right now. So there's some questions that were more kind of baseline, maybe a little bit off topic or focused, just about that person just wanted to understand striped bass management a little bit better. Those are all fine. We encourage everyone to always ask questions, even if you don't know. But there were some that I don't think build towards the understanding and the participation that we're going to get to in the next five days, give or take. Oh, Christ, yeah. Just about 5 days. So, Tony, to keep us rolling, any immediate aftermath thoughts? We had the presentation last night. We had a Q&A period. ASGA has since we've launched our Striper Alert page. You can find our draft letter that will be finalized once everyone signs on to it. You can find that on the Striper Action Alert on our webpage right now. What are your maybe initial aftermath thoughts? What do you want people to consider while they're listening to what happened?
Okay, so this is what I want everyone to kind of consider a little bit. Man, if y'all have been with us for a while, you know how many of these documents we've gone through. This one's, you know, we're in a bad place with stripers. This document had to be done really quickly. And I don't, usually with these documents, we can zero in and say this is a viable solution. But each one of the solutions presented created issues from us from a, is this a sound science standpoint? Is this equitable for everyone? Is this going to help? And there were, unfortunately, most of the solutions checked the box of no, this is bad. I just want to offer, I know this is going to sound repetitive for people who listen to our podcast or actually read our stuff, but you know, we're seeing stuff online that are people are like, these organizations support no targeting closure. We have never supported no targeting closure in our lives, nor will we. As a matter of fact, you know, we're the only organization that stared at the document for 3 days until the light bulb went off and said, holy mackerel, they're basing this off of absolute garbage provided by Maryland DNR, garbage science. And then we spend the next 4 hours doing MRIP queries, creating charts and graphs. And that's what you're going to see on our letter. But we're the only ones shooting holes in it. So, like, I guess, you know what? You know what Lefty always used to tell me? Wind always blows hardest at the top of the flagpole. So, you know, if you don't know what that means, that means when you're a leader, people are just going to say ridiculous things that are untrue, and you got to have a thick skin and just keep going. So
it is interesting to say, even outside the bounds of ASGA, Tony, I mean, there's who is out here right now supporting this in the community. There are a lot of different groups who have various levels of opinions that align with us. Some do, some don't, some are somewhat similar and everywhere in between. You know, there kind of is a spectrum of opinions on a lot of this stuff. Do you see anyone running and screaming, running with the ball, saying that this is the solution for going forward? One of the things I want people to take away when they listen to these comments is I've left some of the comments in that maybe are from people who haven't agreed with our approach to stuff in the past, and listen and kind of hear the tone and the takeaway. There's panic in a lot of people's voices.
Oh, Cody, boy,
it's kind of like, we wanted this, but like, well, I want this, but you know, I hope this doesn't affect me, right? Like, yeah. I wanted that to hurt
all the people in the Guides Association, these no target enclosures, and oh God, it's going to hurt me too. Oh, wait a minute. I don't want that. So, you know, listen, y'all, with any of the closures, we would support an equitable harvest closure that was relative to what a state's, how long their season is and how many fish they harvest. And when you say, okay, it's going to be 50 days long, Maine to North Carolina, I mean, that's not fair. I mean, first of all, North Carolina hadn't caught a striper in like 8 years. So like, I don't know. Why don't you just include South Carolina or Florida? I mean, and then Maine, it's just their season's a third of what some mid-Atlantic states are. They don't harvest anything. Neither is New Hampshire. It's minimal. It's like a speck on the horizon. And to hold them to the same time period, that's why these are not acceptable options. And then now check this out. If you live in a state that has a 10 or 12 month fishery, you get your smorgasbord. You pick whatever wave you want, pretty much. So I could turn around and be like, oh yeah, I want the last 4 weeks of December because we don't fish anyway. Ha ha ha. I mean, I don't know. Give Maine that option. They'll probably like it better. So it's just, look, striped bass are in trouble. People are starting to panic. Finding out where we stand and who we are is literally one click away. We're hearing the most crazy stuff ever, but you know, we don't really care. We're used to it. But we put all this out so the people who actually do want to pay attention and really understand, you may not agree with us, but at least you know where we stand. None of the closures are equitable. That's harvest and no targeting. They don't make a lot of sense. The no targeting is based on a throne of lies. You know, please listen to the previous podcast and you'll hopefully be able to hear our comments on no targeting. And then this recap of the meeting, and we pretty much shredded it like a nice fresh chunk of mozzarella. Instead of mozzarella. So.
There are a bunch of people right now, Tony, that are, I think, a little bit blindsided if they haven't been paying attention. And typically used to not participating, not really worried about the slot changes, whatever. I just do my thing. I fish. And then we've caught a lot of people, not ASGA, but where this is all going, the striped bass community and management has caught a lot of people off guard. They're going, wait, hold on. You're going to shut me down for a couple months? And now all of a sudden people care. So you're going to see a lot of reactions out there. And if we're going to leave them with a final takeaway, Tony, as we kick off some recordings of the comments last night, or questions last night, I'm going to have this start right now with an answer from Katie to kind of the third part of my time on the microphone, where she very explicitly said, if anyone is looking at this now blindsided or has been paying attention, you can't believe these are the options that are on the table. Remember, the board is what directed the TC. That is who directed the TC to make these the options. Focus on no targeting. It comes from the board.
Yeah.
And so who determines what is prioritized when the TC goes back? Because a lot of time was put into
these.
The board. The board is the one who tasks us with this and tells us what the priorities are. And so this was what the priorities that we got from the board was, is what we have presented to you here today. So if the board would like us to work on this further, they can task us with this at the next meeting.
Thanks, Tony. So I'm seeing a lot of hands. So I'm just going to start going down my list. So I see Tony Friedrich.
Hey, Emily, do you have me?
Yes, thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for the great presentation, Emily. I have a question and a potential follow-up. So in reviewing the document on page 82, it states, I'm just going to quote it, in the case of Maryland, previous Chesapeake Bay season closure analysis, and I think that seasonal closure was a, just to be more specific, it was a seasonal target closure analysis, seemed like a reasonable assumption given the eliminate striped bass trips only, seemed like a reasonable assumption given the dynamics of the Chesapeake Bay fishing, which are heavily focused on targeting striped bass. This assumption, this is the important part, this assumption was validated by realized reductions in Maryland that it's exceeded expected reductions. So my question is this, we reviewed the MRIP data for total harvest versus directed trips in Maryland. And there was actually an increase in directed trips in 2018 and 2020. The 2018 was the first year that the no targeting closures were implemented. 2020 was the year that they were expanded. It was kind of shocking to see an increase in effort with the understanding that no targeting is supposed to control effort. As an example, in 2016, there were 2.2 million trips with a total harvest A plus B1 plus B2 of over 15 million fish. And that's about 7 fish per trip. In 2022, that average was down to 7 million fish with 2.115 million directed trips. Through wave 4 in 2024, we're down to a little over 500,000 trips and 800,000 total catch. So my question is this, how can we base a new type of closure on a false assumption of the effectiveness of this closure? If no targeting is the reason for Maryland exceeding their goals, why is that not reflected in the effort? These are sweeping changes, a totally new management paradigm that'll essentially, you know, the further north you go, have a greater impact and just annihilate their economy. So did the TC just accept Maryland's, the effectiveness of this, how Maryland DNR presented no targeting, or did they kind of dig in to the actual MRIP numbers and look at the reality that we don't have a lot of fish and no one's fishing anymore?
Thanks, Tony. So the TC reviewed the Maryland DNR no targeting data back in September. And Maryland DNR presented, they did a wave by wave analysis for when their no targeting closures were implemented. Starting in 2020, those expanded no targeting closures in Maryland. And the TC did ask for some additional information, which DNR provided, particularly around wave 2, March and April. But the TC felt that the analysis was sufficient to document the decrease in effort and removals that Maryland saw during the waves in which their no targeting closures were occurring.
Just a follow up, there was an increase in effort in 2000. From 2017, there were 2.116 million trips. In 2018, there were 2.150. In 19, there was 1.53. And in 20, there was 2.115. So those years, the first year and then the expansion year, there was actually an increase in trips and there was a drop in total catch, again, because we have no fish. So, you know, my question is, we spent a lot of time reviewing these numbers again, and they do not represent the assertion that a no targeting closure is the reason why Maryland exceeded their goals, because it's not. Again, original question, how can we base this type of closure on false assumptions?
Thanks, Tony. So again, you know, the DNR analysis that was presented to the TC, it wasn't looking at the year in total. It was wave specific based on when the closure was occurring. So that might be where the different effort analysis is if you're just looking at certain waves. The TC, you know, presented both of these different assumptions for no targeting closures. You know, on the one end, the striped bass only trips eliminated as Maryland used in their previous analysis, and also the assumption on the other end that all striped bass trips would still occur with a new target. You know, and that's a question for the board in terms of what assumption they think is most reasonable.
Thank you, Emily. I appreciate it.
Next, I have Chris Weil.
Hi, thanks, Emily. I appreciate the presentation. Just a quick question, follow up. In the difference between doing the no trips through the no harvest, what's the mortality rate assumption there?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So if you're referring to the release mortality rate, it's 9% for all of these different assumptions. So just very quickly, so if you're doing for the no harvest closure, so catch and release is still allowed. We mm-hmm. assume that during the no harvest closure, of course, there's no more harvest, and any fish that was previously harvested is now counted as a release. So we're actually counting, you know, we have a reduction in harvest and a slight increase in releases using that 9% rate, because all those fish that were previously harvested, we assume are now released. For the no targeting closures, we're assuming we're seeing both a reduction in harvest and also in a reduction in the number of fish released. But we still assume there's a 9% mortality rate for any fish that is released.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Next, I have Gregory Koch. Go ahead, Gregory.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Thank you for taking this question. I apologize. I may be rather simplistic, but in my mind, with regard to no harvest, that's rather binary, right, from an enforcement standpoint. But no targeting from someone who lives a mile from the beach with many species available, what does that mean from a regulatory perspective? How enforcement? I'm unclear on that. Thank you for your time. And I apologize if this is out of scope.
Oh, no problem. Thanks, Greg. That is a great question. The Law Enforcement Committee at the Commission has provided information on enforcement to the Management Board. And the Law Enforcement Committee has indeed noted that enforcement of no targeting closures is very difficult. So I think that's something the board will consider. They might consider that when they're making a decision of whether or not to move forward with no targeting closures. Next, I have Tom Fody.
Thank you, Emily. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Could you put up the wave data, the wave reductions again? Yeah, when I look at the districts you put in wave six, it's Rhode Island to North Carolina. Yet if you look at the wave six and who's catching fish, some of those states are not going to take a reduction at all. So are we going to break it down to show, like if you close wave six, you know, the reduction might be on New Jersey for 25% of it and New York for another 25%. And then Massachusetts and Rhode Island get maybe a 2% reduction because their fishery is not in wave six. So we can have a better estimation of what those states are catching in those waves so we can predict the effect on each state, which would be dramatically different just opening us all in one area, especially when the waves are different in every state when they catch fish.
Thanks, Tom. So we don't have a breakdown by state. Just by the region as a whole. I think perhaps that's something the board would consider when they're thinking about, you know, which of these different regional breakdowns they might go with. You know, there's probably a lot of potential considerations in terms of which regional breakdown to choose, but you're right that, you know, these closures will, the impact of these closures will depend on when the fishery is occurring in each state, and that's different for each state.
Thank you.
And next I have George Baldwin. Go ahead, George.
Hi, thank you, Emily. I'm just wondering what effect the possibilities of further recruitment failures in the Chesapeake would have on these figures and the estimates of the chances of rebuilding the stocks. You know, is that a concern with those plans? Was that taken into effect, or is that not really a factor in the plans here?
Thanks, George. So the board has noted that they are concerned about the continued low recruitment. But because for this rebuilding timeline, we're looking only to 2029, the recent years of, you know, the lowest recruitment, you know, in the most recent years, those fish will only just be entering that spawning stock biomass by 2029. So the effect of those low recruitment years might be more pronounced after 2029. So, you know, these current figures, you know, take into account the recent recruitment, but those fish are still a little bit too young to really be impacting the spawning stock biomass yet.
Okay, so a buffer really wouldn't be desirable in that situation, of buffering the number of bass that are older and available to reproduce? Because if we have a greater spawning biomass to start with, wouldn't that produce more recruitment than starting with a lower spawning biomass? If a certain percentage are dying off, like that percentage of a higher number of eggs, let's say, would leave more recruitment than the same percentage that dies off of a smaller number of eggs, right? That's just my thought. I'm not sure how, you know, applicable that is, but.
Yeah, I'm going to see if Dr. Drew has anything at this point, maybe on the spawn-recruit relationship.
Sure. So I would say for striped bass, the relationship between sort of that spawning stock biomass and how much recruitment is produced is relatively weak, which means that you can have a low SSB, a low spawning stock biomass, and still produce strong year classes if the environmental conditions are right. But the flip side of that is that if the environmental conditions are not right, even if you have a lot of SSB out there, you may still get a series of weak year classes, which is sort of what we've been seeing now. So the level of SSB that we're at right now has in the past been able to produce really strong year classes, but the environmental conditions that we're seeing right now seem to be influencing recruitment more than the available spawning stock biomass. So absolutely, there's a relationship in the sense that, you know, if you don't have any striped bass spawners out there, you're not going to get any recruitment. And if you do have spawners out there, you're going to get some level of recruitment. But, you know, I don't think we can exactly say, you know, if we rebuild to a higher level or if we try to have a more abundant striped bass, will that lead to more recruitment, better recruitment? It may not if the environmental conditions are not favorable for recruitment, which is where we seem to be right now. So, you know, I think I certainly wouldn't want to say, yeah, you know, let's drive the stock down further. That'll help. Obviously that will not help. But, you know, the flip side of this is as we, you know, continue to rebuild spawning stock biomass, that is not a guarantee that we will be able to get back to some of those recruitment events that we saw in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Next, I have Dominic Pucci. Go ahead, Dominic.
Thanks, Emily. Especially thank you for clearing up this. Trying to read through this was a little difficult. I have two questions, and the first is kind of a reiteration. So nobody from enforcement saw these, you know, was involved with the TC at all right?
So not directly with the technical committee, but the law enforcement committee has provided input on no targeting closures to the board multiple times, and has indicated that it's very difficult to enforce.
Yeah, right. They're not in favor of it at all. So it's kind of interesting that the bulk of this presentation is based on no targeting. The second is, you said that it didn't make any sense for lowering the slot. What population distribution did they use for that analysis? What data did they use?
I'm going to again.
How did they build the target population of fish?
I'm going to defer to Dr. Drew, see if she can help me out.
Sure. So what we did for this analysis was basically we have information on the length frequency of fish that are released alive from a bunch of different sources. So some of this comes from volunteer angler logbook programs. Some of it comes from volunteer tagging programs. Some of it comes from the MRIP headboat data. So we have information on kind of the length frequency of fish that are released alive. And we also obviously have information on the length frequency of fish that are harvested from MRIP. And so we basically looked at that length frequency of fish that were that were released alive, which tends to be, for the ocean states, definitely tends to be running up to, or there's a lot of fish in that 28 and less bins. And so we were able to use that length distribution to basically say, if you had released a fish before, we don't, and that's the problem, right? Is for each trip, we know the lengths of the fish that were harvested, but we don't know the lengths of the fish that were released on that trip. We can sort of get an overall length distribution for the total releases, but we don't know on a trip by trip basis, did you catch undersized fish only, or did you catch any legal size fish and release them? So we were able, what we did was basically just say, given the length frequency of the released fish that we know about from these other sources, what's your probability that on a trip you could have caught a fish that was undersized, but that could be moved into a legal size if we lower that slot? And so that's where that data came from. And that's where that analysis came from, is basically looking at the length frequency of released fishes from a time. We picked a year where we thought it would represent the 2018s being available to how big or the distribution that would represent the 2018s. And that's what we used for that length frequency to describe those releases.
Okay, then did you have no fish basically after 2018? I mean, there's a big hole based on the young of the year following up to 2018. So did you use your standard distribution, or did you make that distribution less?
So,
which would be assumed, right?
Right. So we used, so basically the 2018s are going to be in 2025, which is when we're going to do these regulations, they're going to be age 7 in 2025. And so we used the data from 2018 to represent when the 2011s would have been age 7 in order to represent kind of, so the 2018s are above average. It's true that they're not as abundant as some of these other year classes, but they're a little stronger than what we've seen for other years. And so basically next year, they're going to be sort of just entering that 28 to 31 inch slot. So about half of them are going to be 28 and bigger, and about half of them are going to be less than 28. So that covers, so the distribution that we used, we tried to make it represent a situation that we expect to happen in 2025, in terms of there's an above average year class coming through, and they're going to be right around that 28 inch size limit. And that's kind of and as a result of that, that's why moving down an inch or two doesn't actually reduce your catch at all. It's because you can now, all of those fish that would have been too small that you had to throw back, you can keep one of those and you can swap out a larger fish for one of these more abundant smaller fish. And as a result, you don't really get a savings just going down an inch or two in that slot.
Okay, so you didn't look at a more reduced slot, say 24 to 22 or something like that, because that probably would have saved a lot of fish, because there's not many fish there to catch. That is
so enormous. We didn't look very, partly because we didn't have time, but we didn't look at a much smaller distribution, in part because I think the other concern about this is that you're basically then switching all of that pressure to those smaller fish. So I think if the TC were going to kind of pursue this further, we would want to make sure that the slot limit and the reductions that we're getting are not going to like be offset by the fact that now you're fishing on immature fish and you're directing all that harvest pressure on fish that haven't had a chance to reproduce yet. And it's true that they're going to be less abundant. So that might, you know, reduce the overall effort and reduce the overall catch. But we would want to do more work to make sure that we wouldn't be having unintended consequences for the SSB in the long term.
Yeah, no, I understand. But at least you'd be protecting all the big spawners if something, you know, if that was done for a couple of years and all the spawners would be protected. And then, and okay, all right, I understand. The other thing, though, it really, the commission should really get a hold on the commercial.
Hey, Dominic.
Yeah, okay.
I'm making it. It's just that we have a lot of hands, and so I want to make sure we can get everyone.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm going to go to the question box. I see a lot of questions. I'm just going to do one or two of the first questions I see, and then I'll go back to people with their hands up. So in the question box, someone asked, why would the goal be not to have a higher than 50% probability? Why not make the reductions in catch reflect a probability of 75%? So that goal of a 50% probability of rebuilding is specified by the board. The board did request an extra projection, which is in the report, looking at a 60% probability, which, as you might imagine, would require a slightly higher reduction than a 50% probability. But the board has specified that 50% is what they're aiming for. Jim Hutchinson, go ahead.
Yeah, I think Ray just asked my question, but I'm going to try this again, maybe just to kind of delve a little bit deeper, because I'm curious about this as well. That state by state, obviously, there's the inequity of the waves. And Emily, you just asked, you said the enforcement issue, kind of state by state boundaries, which you're still going to have on a regional basis, too. So maybe this answer is it's a two part question, but I don't know if I heard you say it. As opposed to regional and coastwide, in that whole document, is a state by state MRIP wave closure in play? I mean, could states then theoretically choose the combination that works best? And on that topic, just as Massachusetts wave six is different from New Jersey wave six, New Jersey is two different states as well, between North and South Jersey. Is there a way for states to take the reduction required in two different waves, for example, wave six and wave two?
Thanks for that question. For this particular analysis, no, the options are only the regions that you see up here, or all states would take the same closure. For example, if the board decided to pursue an addendum at some point for seasonal closures, there could be options for state by state or something like that. But for this particular action, the only options are the region breakdowns you see in the report.
So the answer then is there is no option come December 16th for states to determine what's best for them.
Correct. They would have to match the same wave as the other states in their region.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next I have Ben Wally. Go ahead, Ben.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate the presentation and for taking questions. I realize this is a management decision and not a technical committee decision, but I'm curious how we can propose the same days of closures for Maine to New Jersey when the southern states have three times the duration of the season. So my main question for the TC or SAS is, do these closures take into account boosted effort before before and after closures. Meaning if you shut down half of my season, I'm gonna try to run as many trips as daylight allows in the days surrounding that to make up my income. How does that factor in? And in Maine, you know, no target closures for me means no trips since we don't have alternate species. So appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. So this analysis does not take into account that potential to shift effort outside of the closure. So that I think is a source of uncertainty in these calculations. And then I think just to your, you know, question about, you know, differential impacts for states that have much shorter seasons than other states. I think in the report, you know, for all these options, it shows for each region, what's the impact to that region specifically. So I think that helps to sort of, you know, answer if someone is wondering, you know, would this closure disproportionately impact one region over another? I think in the report, it sort of shows you if one region is disproportionately impacted, depending on the option.
Yeah, except the no closure, or the closure, the no target closures, you know, assumes that charters are targeting alternate species, which Maine cannot do. So there's that. Anyways, I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Next, I have Blaine Chocolate. Go ahead.
All right. Sorry about that. My question's about the proposed reductions by sector. In light of fairness and equitable management, how can we consider a reduction off quota a legitimate reduction for commercials if they don't meet quota? Is that reduction not just disappearing as it represents fish that aren't being caught and sold anyway? Because it looks as though commercial had not been contributing to conservation at the same rate during this process.
Thanks, Blaine. So yeah, that question about taking a reduction off of the commercial quota versus taking a reduction off commercial harvest. The board has discussed that in the past. And I think if I remember correctly, it may have been brought up at the recent October meeting as well. But as far as this particular action, the option on the table is to reduce commercial quota.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Explain. Next, I have Cody Rubner.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I do want to start by saying thank you guys for staying so long and giving us this opportunity, because I think I was on the last call for like 5 hours and didn't get a chance on the mic. So I really do appreciate you guys doing this presentation and giving us the opportunity. So I'm going to touch back on a topic that's been brought up before, but I just need a little bit more clarity. So on page 23 of the memorandum, I think it was 96 in the draft document, they talk about the simulation analysis for size limits under 28 inches and looking at potentially dropping the slot, not its width, but the actual size of the fish. So in that appendix, it states that for all slot limit analyses, 2018 removals data were used as a proxy for 2025. And Katie touched on that a little bit, comparing how 2011 was for 2018, what 2018 could be for 2025. I think also on page 80, it states that targeting smaller fish or fish smaller than 28 inches could shift harvest away from the 15s and the 18s, which everyone knows are critical classes and our last good ones. And actually, page 80 says this may be desirable by some stakeholders from a management perspective, but the harvest of immature fish would increase. And so to touch back on the data of looking at the juvenile YOY coming out of the bay, which everyone involved in striped bass management knows is, you know, is the rock for measuring production. So you look at 2011, comparing it to 2018, and this is where I need some clarity and where my question lies. 2011 was twice the production that 2018 is. So I feel like there is a little bit of danger in comparing those two. But if you look at the average from 11 to 17, which is kind of being used as the proxy for what would be 18 to 2025, the average in juvenile production goes from 13.12 in that time span, which is still above
the time series average. And then when you look at 18 to 2024, it's 4.35. So you have 75% less spawning production in these two time windows. So how can we compare them and say that that's an appropriate or fair proxy that would reflect the smaller fish? And I think that's what the other gentleman was getting at, or like those fish don't exist if we look at the spawning numbers that everyone believes is a big part of this. So did the TC and SAS take into consideration the vast difference in spawning production in these two windows? And I know, Katie, you said time was limited, and totally understand, especially even from the advocacy side, time is very limited with this. But why were so many resources allocated to these no targeting closure analyses that have been very comprehensive, and none was spent on considering those smaller classes, which page 80 clearly states many advocates and stakeholders would want to see from a management perspective? So I just need some clarity to understand how we can reasonably assume that lowering the slot would not have a greater impact in reducing F in the next few years than status quo, and simultaneously protect those two really important year classes. Any clarity here would be greatly, greatly appreciated.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start and then I'll pass it to Dr. Drew. Excuse me. So when the board tasked the TC with exploring this less than 28 inch option in October, during the meeting, the TC chair noted that this would be a big lift in this timeframe because this analysis requires additional data, not just MRIP data. So, I think that's one thing to consider, is this was, new analysis, new data sources. But I think the other, thing to consider is that trade-off of harvesting immature fish and sort of the need to, even if there was a reduction calculated for one of these smaller size limits, the next step would be to calculate, I believe, a spawning potential analysis to determine, is that reduction actually offset by the fact that we're harvesting immature fish? So that just sort of maybe high level, but I'll pass it to Dr. Grew.
Yeah, and I think the only thing I would add to that would be that those younger fish are, they haven't been killed off as much by natural mortality yet. So it's true that they're definitely weaker than the 2018s are partially in this range. But they're also, what's coming up behind is definitely weaker than the 2018s. But they just have not been killed down as much by natural mortality or other fishing mortality at this point. And so they are still relatively abundant in the population, in the sense that, if the fishery is out there, then people will have the opportunity to basically replace a legal size, a fish that is currently legal. So if we go from, right now we're at 28 to 31, we go down to say 27 to 30, you can basically replace those fish that were legal before with a smaller fish and basically get no net harvest. Meanwhile, people have been catching a number of these small undersized fish and now can actually keep them instead of having to throw them back. And so it's true that the what's coming in now is not as abundant as that 2011 year class would have been, but it's more about how many of those trips that are out there that are occurring are going to encounter these small fish and be able to take a fish that maybe before they would not have been able to because of the size limit, or be able to replace a previously legal fish with one of these smaller fish. I think, there is definitely more work that we could do on this front if we had more time to both look at maybe going down further, or maybe, maybe we don't do this in 2025. Maybe we do this for future years where we have more weaker year classes available. I think the other thing to consider, though, is it's true that, protecting the 2018s and the 2015s is worthwhile because those are what is supporting this rebuilding trajectory. But thinking ahead to the future, those 2018s and those 2015s will not last forever. And so I think you have to, I think part of what the TC would want to do with this kind of analysis is compare that long-term trade-off of if we protect the 2018s and the 2015s for as long as we can, what is the benefit there versus what happens in the long term after we just shift all of that effort to these weak year classes coming through? Is there any, you know, in the long run, if we weaken the spawning stock biomass coming up behind the 2018s and the 2015s, what are we going to do, you know, 10 years, 20 years from now, when that is the core of your SSB? So that's, you know, that's, I think, what we would want to do. The other thing, and so the flip side of this is we're talking about shifting harvest from one size class to another versus the point of the no targeting closures. And I think why the board was interested in this is an effort to actually reduce effort and to take fewer trips rather than say, okay, we're going to trade in one 28-inch fish for a 26-inch or a 24-inch fish.
So I have a quick follow-up. I know there's probably a lot of other people with their hands up. All of that makes total sense to me, Katie, except for the fact that it's focused on reducing a total impact on fish that don't exist, right? I mean, like those previous after 2011, which is to 2017, leading up to 2018, which is being used as the proxy. So we are saying that this is a perfect or as close to an example as we can look at. The 2013, 2014, 2015, 2017s are all close to average, or 15 was way above average. We are like significantly lower than 3, which is not even 33% of the time series average from 2018 to 2024. So I'm really having a hard time conceptualizing. I know there are traditionally more smaller fish in a fishery than big fish. I understand how that scale of classes works. That being said, the way this fishery is set up with all the data that I trust and believe and all the scientists and data recruitment that's gone into this, these fish don't exist. So these spawns haven't happened. And I know you talked about 10 years from now, but that's even after the rebuilding timeline. So how do we conceptualize and recommend something based off of after we get past 18, there is literally nothing coming for the following 5 years? I'm just really having a hard time. Everything you said makes sense if there's more small fish coming down. And I know there's a distribution scale, but any clarity you can provide on how we're not looking at those 6 straight poor year classes as fish that don't exist. That's what's really hard for me to understand.
I mean, they exist. That's the problem. They exist. They're just so every fish that you take out of there is going to have a bigger impact than taking a fish out of, if that had been the 2018 or the 2015 year class, taking a single fish out of there would have less of an impact than it's going to have on these fish coming through. So if all of the effort, if we're not reducing effort, if we're still taking the same number of trips and we're interacting with fish in the same way, then yes, there's going to be lower catch for sure, but we're taking that lower catch out of a smaller population. And so the available size distribution that we have of, you know, and again, we're not talking about this in terms of total numbers. We're talking about this in the distribution of, you know, what is more abundant versus less abundant in terms of what is released. And they're there, they're just going to be, and they're available for harvest if we lower that size limit. And so the question, I think, that is not clear to us yet and that we have not done the work for, because this is a new analysis and we haven't had the time for it, is what is the impact of taking those, of swapping those fish in for the larger available fish? They are there. It's just going to have more of an impact to take out one of those than it would have if that was a larger year class.
And so who determines what is prioritized when the TC goes back? Because a lot of time was put into these.
The board is the one who tasks us with this and tells us what the priorities are. And so this was what the priorities that we got from the board is what we have presented to you here today. So if the board would like us to work on this further, they can task us with this at the next meeting.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate all the time on the mic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Cody. Next, I have Parker Mock. Go ahead, Parker.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
I understand that the board has the ability to modify and you know do these actions in 2025 without an addendum. What happens in 26 through 29 if it seems obvious that we need to do more? Do they have that ability in those years, or will those years require addendums?
So this board action in particular is sort of tied to the outcome of the 2024 stock assessment. So the next time the board could do something without an addendum would be the next stock assessment, if that stock assessment said we had a less than 50% probability of rebuilding. So, you know, this is the specific board action the board can do based on the last stock assessment. And then until the next stock assessment, the board will have to act through addenda.
So just to clarify, so in future years, every time there's a stock assessment, there's an opportunity for the board to take actions without an addendum if the numbers are below a certain level?
Only for this rebuilding plan, so through 2029.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Parker. Next, I have Joseph LeClaire. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, my question is this. Has anybody spoken to FWC in Florida about the non-targeting procedures that they've tried to implement and the programs that they've addressed, in some cases followed through with? And I mean, anybody there, anybody at FWC?
So I know Florida participates on the law enforcement committee through the commission. So I'm not sure if the law enforcement committee has covered this in their discussions. I can find out, but I don't know.
Okay. And if there are correspondence, can you publish them?
Correspondence, do you mean?
With any other states that's already implemented the non-targeting and any other states that have tried to implement the non-targeting, can you publish the correspondence? Can you make us aware of the information that you get?
Sure. So yeah, I will talk to the law enforcement committee coordinator to understand if he has any information from Florida. And then as far as other no-targeting closures, there are some current no-targeting closures in place for striped bass, particularly in some spawning areas. And
I understand. And those rivers in Virginia are, you know, you can't walk on where they're spawning. I get it. But like Ben Wally said a minute ago, people are going to load up on the weeks before and after the closures, and other states have already looked.
Joseph, I just
sorry. Comment
again. It's a comment, and we have a lot of hands.
I just want to know if you guys are looking into this, because there's been a lot done in other states already.
Yep, and representatives from the Florida Fish and Wildlife, as Emily said, the law enforcement committee's analysis or recommendations are posted in meeting materials and previous meetings, as well as their report is available via the YouTubes when they've talked about it from the commission's webpage. So we have all of that as public information already, because it has been discussed at least, I can remember it at least three times.
Okay, so you guys are using that historical data?
I mean, we're
That's all I wanted to know.
Yeah. I mean, but they're very current conversations. They've been talking about them this year.
I can send you some of the reports from the law enforcement committee about recent conversations about no targeting.
So the enforcement is one side of it, but they've contemplated the economic impacts. They've contemplated a lot of different things where the fish are spawning. They've done a bunch of stuff. So it's not just the enforcement.
So, I mean, other than the enforcement, that's been the primary discussion point as far as what other states are doing. I don't think the board has talked in great detail about, I think, what you're referring to.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I have Eric Summers. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, thank you for all of your efforts. So my understanding is that larger fish are much more fecund than smaller fish, way out of proportion to weight. And, you know, that's a great rationale for having a slot. But if you really care about fecundity across the population, you need to, I think, look at the weight distribution of the spawning biomass to make decisions effectively. It seems that a big fish is worth keeping no matter who catches it. And, understanding, what the potential, the breeding potential of the group is depends upon that size distribution. So I wonder, has that ever been collected? And is there any plan to collect it in the future?
I'm going to turn to Dr. Drew to see if there's anything in the stock assessment that might be helpful.
Sure. We do collect information, obviously, on the catch at age, or, what's the age of all of the fish that we are that are being caught? What are the ages of the fish that are being released? As well as information that we can then extrapolate to, how heavy these fish are. We don't really have sort of newer information or more updated information on fecundity, that is the number of eggs that each fish is producing. So we are using weight as kind of a proxy for that. And it's definitely true that you want your population, your spawning population, to have a wide age structure, to have a lot of old fish, because they are more fecund and they're contributing more and better quality eggs to the population. The thing to keep in mind, though, when you're thinking about this, is that the only way that we get big old fish is if they survive to be that old. So we can't just magically make new big fish appear. And the way they survive to be that old is that we minimize the mortality that they experience along their lifespan. So I think the way these things sort of interact in terms of where you put the effort, what size fish you're catching, in a lot of cases is less important than the overall effort, the overall fishing mortality, the number of fish you're taking out of this population overall, so that we can ensure that enough of these currently small fish can survive to be old, fecund females.
Right. I just wonder if, for the purposes of restoring a population today, whether the largest fish have extra value. That's just something I wonder. Thank you for taking my question.
Thanks, Eric. Next, I have Nick Jones. Go ahead, Nick.
Emily, thank you, guys. A great presentation. And thank you for giving us the podium for asking questions. So my question has been touched on a bit, but I'm still going to ask it because I would love to hear a definitive answer to my question. In the previous meeting, it was on record that targeting closures were the least enforceable of the 26 different options. I mean, as we know, the law enforcement is underfunded and understaffed, and if targeting closures are essentially unenforceable, they take away from their time enforcing more serious natural resource violations. Has their position on the enforceability of targeting closures changed since the last meeting?
No, their law enforcement committee's position has not changed. It's up to the board to decide how to weigh that in terms of moving forward.
Okay, perfect. So then my follow-up question is, since there seems to be a lot of weight on these non-targeting closures, that information about law enforcement's position is included in the TC's suggestion to the board, and is that being considered by the board?
So that the law enforcement recommendations are separate from the TC recommendations. The TC provides the technical calculations, and the law enforcement committee provides their input. And the law enforcement committee has provided their input to the board multiple times on no targeting closures. So I think the board has been made well aware of their position.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Next, I have Michael Carroll. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, Mike Carroll here. Just a couple questions, or one, really one. I think the report notes major uncertainty in the projections, which I think is obvious to everyone that, you know, the difference between certain scenarios where it's do nothing versus, you know, make some major changes. And then the report goes further into simulating or presenting different management options. One thing that I wanted to note is those management options have a pretty tremendous impact, economic impact in communities throughout the eastern United States. What has been done for economic impact reports? Basically, the Magnuson-Stevens Act Standard 8 requires that consideration be done for economic impacts of the community. So I'm just wondering what extensive report has been done with those management scenarios to address that, present that to the board and the committee that are making these important decisions.
Thanks, Mike, for your question. So as part of the FMPs, there is a section on socioeconomic information. And I believe the last sort of big economic impact study was by Southwick Associates, published in 2019, based on some earlier data. So that's been, you know, included in the FMPs for a couple of years now, but I'm not aware of any other more recent economic impact studies.
2019 study would be completely irrelevant. You had none of this information was forward, and you had no management scenarios to address or to review what that meant for economic impact. So that would be completely irrelevant in this scenario. So I'm just curious, do they plan to do that before they make this big decision? Because it's a large decision and could trigger over $100 million in impacts across the whole Northeast or Eastern United States, which is a big issue. So I think I'm just curious if the board is going to consider that and get one of those analyses done before they make this decision, because I think that would be really important to all that participate in this fishery, because you're talking about economic impacts all the way from, you know, the vessels all the way through the economy, right through, you know, recreational fishery has tremendous numbers. So
Michael, so I think that what, as a commission, we often rely on the states to provide the board with economic impact information because we do fall under NOAA fisheries and don't have that social science branch to provide the same types of regulations that NOAA fishery does under the Magnuson, whereas the commission is not under the Magnuson Act. So therefore we rely on the states to provide that economic information to us. But if you feel that it is important to be done prior to, then you should include that in your comments to the board. I appreciate that.
I will. Thank you very much.
And thanks for everyone's patience. We only have about 7 more hands, so we're going to try to get to everyone. So next I have Kyle Schaefer. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for the great presentation, taking the time tonight. I'll make have a quick question tonight. I'm all for making sacrifices to repair this fishery, but with Maine having such low removals and therefore a much lower impact on the fishery as a whole, combined with a short season, I'm wondering if the board and the TC is taking into account why is this an equitable option to have Maine be required to take the same length of a seasonal closure to that of a state that has an exponentially greater harvest and potentially a longer season.
Thanks, Kyle. So yeah, I think, you know, for this analysis, the TC was sort of using the same structure that was used a couple of years ago when the board was considering options for seasonal closures in draft addendum 2, where they were only looking at closures where you're doing the same amount of time for the closure per each region. And I think, as you mentioned, that's one way to look at equity. Another way is you're describing it as, you know, perhaps proportion of the season or something like that. So I think for a future addendum, that is a way the board could proceed. But as far as this addenda or this action, if the board were to move forward, the options are laid out here as is, and the board, you know, could consider equity in terms of how they move forward.